Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for the invitation and letting me talk. Just noting in advance, I think it was a bit of a short notice, quick setup, so I'm very happy you have me. And we couldn't organize that I'm there in person, but maybe we can do that sometime later. But of course, even before that, just reach out to me if you have any questions after today's talk. It was very timely because we recently had this accepted, and I think it's a good time to talk about it. And second thing, so I already mentioned, I know you're a strong gravity physics with the very fundamental processes, and this is a very plasma focused talk. So I hope it can be interesting for you. And if you want to me to circle in on any of the more fundamental questions, just interrupt me and let me make it interesting for you. Yes, so today I want to talk about this story that we have developed pretty much in the last 2 years, which comprises basically two projects. One of them focuses on magnetar eruptions or instabilities in the magnetospheres, and the other project focused on FRB generation. And as it turns out, we can very neatly connect the two. And this is what this talk is going to be about. Quick mention of two people on this first slide. So we have Haik Hakobian here, and Vasilios Mevis. Both of them are very much focused on code development. And as I will show some simulations, please let's acknowledge these people that always spend a lot of time making everything work. And yeah, I'm very grateful to have them. Okay, let me give a quick introduction on what are we looking at. So the source we have in mind are magnetars. These are rapidly rotating neutron stars, as many of you will know, but I just still give you the rundown. The period of rotation is slower than what we usually used to from pulsars, so we are between 2 to 12 seconds with exceptions. Most of them are discovered because they are extremely active in the X-ray. So there's bursting activity. Actually, it's also how they first have been discovered, some very energetic burst that has been observed. And this is very, so that there's a lot of different bursting activity that will be important for this effect. They have rapid spin down, so you can infer large magnetic fields. The spectra you have can be complicated. So while part of the phase resolve spectrum is black body, it can get harder if you go to higher frequencies or even be inverse. So the rule to these objects is that a lot of them do not fulfill all the rules, and that's what makes them so exciting for us and what we will study here today. And of course, some of magnetars have been associated to fast radio bursts, which is nice for us because this is actually what we try to explain. In the first part of this talk, I will talk about modeling magnetar magnetospheres, which are very highly magnetized, so that we suppose here that the magnetic dynamics is a dominant process. And of course, it is then accompanied by particle processes and radiation physics. But what we kind of assume here is that a lot of the global dynamics that these secondary processes will then experience is driven by some large-scale motion of magnetic fields. And I know this force-free regime has been also subject to people's work at this institute. And I followed it closely during my whole PhD, so I'm very happy that I can actually present it here. So this is a limit of MHD where you really neglect all inertial quantities. It's solving Maxwell's equations, assuming that you always have enough charges to transport the currents that you need. And the currents that you need are given by the constraint that you do not have electric fields along the magnetic field, so your dissipation is kind of not modeled correctly. And the other constraint is coming from MHD, time-like currents, that you have magnetic dominance. And both of these constraints will become important throughout the talk, so just have them in mind. We can spend a lot of time on the intricate details of how dissipation in these frameworks works. But sometimes not really interesting for everybody. So if there's a deep desire for that, then you can let me know or reach out to me and we can have long discussions on this. So we start with some state of the art modeling that has been done in the last 10 years or so that has mainly been inspired by the giant flare observations that have been with which magnetars basically have first been discovered, and these are X-ray explosions that reach us here that are extremely energetic and usually send a lot of X-ray telescopes, at least at the time, into overflow mode. They have a rapid rise time, and then they have some decay in which you see some periodic structures which are rich in themselves and can be used to do kind of seismology of these objects. A lot of them, or the three like generics one, have been observed in like the past decades ago, basically, but recently it has become important again, because from these extragalactic objects, like this galaxy here, you can see activities that may be caused equally by magnetar giant flares. So these extremely energetic events have inspired modelers in the past to see if twisted magnetospheres, twist being foot points of magnetic fields being moved across each other on the magnetar surface, and therefore storing some kind of free twist energy, could somehow be disrupted and liberate this twist or free energy, and therefore power such giant flare events. This is a simulation that is also in our recent paper, because we kind of did a now it is quite easy to run axisymmetric setups. So what these models were based up on are axisymmetric magnetospheres, which just run a lot of them. On one of them you see here, where you shear the magnetosphere according to this setup. So you kind of have these rings that shear against each other. And what you see is that the sheared field gets quite stressed and eventually opens up the magnetosphere in this large-scale reconnection event. Some flux is ejected, and this can happen over several times as you keep twisting the magnetosphere. So two points that are left to say here. First of all, as these axisymmetric models actually store a lot of free energy during a twisting process, when some of these erupt and all of the 2D models erupt in this particular way, so current sheet projection, flux ejection, you can actually dissipate energy that easily reaches the nominal value of energy available in giant flare events, of course, completely disregarding any radiation physics and conversion here. So with a lot of bursts, we actually reproduce these above giant flare energies in axisymmetric simulations. And this has been known for quite some time. The interesting thing now is that people started to look at analogies with the sun. So here, for example, we see the solar corona in the extreme ultraviolet, and you see a flux rope here that will become dynamic now. And as it becomes ejected, it looks, I don't know if you can see it well, but it looks extremely similar to this kind of field line topology that we have here. So of course, the sun is a very different regime. Plasma is very differently magnetized. Actually, plasma inertia is important. The solar surface is by no means some rigid, perfect conductor like we set it up, but a convective zone that drives these things. But still, we thought we can look at dynamics of solar flux ropes and what they do, and apply them to the magnetar magnetosphere. And this is what we have.
So in this process, the one you're showing, the axisymmetric case, I presume this is episodic, right? So there is a periodicity to it. So you build up this energy, gets released. So how high or higher is the luminosity during the flare with respect to kind of the steady state? And then I guess the periodicity is related to the shearing parameters that you have in your model, right?
Yes. So the periodicity we see here is completely artificial, just induced by our boundary condition. And please note also that we do not include a like global rotation of the star. So that in reality, and people have done that, you would have to model the twisting rate against the stellar rotation. And that would definitely give you some dependence. And in terms of energy, so here we see a release, and this is only dissipated energy of 20% or so of the dipole energy. This means that in total, the magnetosphere has been loaded with like 60% of its initial energy. So I have to disclaim this extremely artificial situation where we twist in a way that in a short time, there's a 60% energy increase in the magnetosphere. This will not happen in nature, but we are kind of limited by numerics, of course, and so we have to make sure we twist slowly enough so that we don't have transients of waves, like we basically go through a series of equilibria, but still get into interesting regimes where you could think that in nature maybe you would have a twisted flux tube that is more or less stable, and then some activity on the surface, and we can discuss later what activity on the surface actually means here, would perturb that and liberate the energy. And this can be quite high if this twisting region is large. So maybe not a conclusive answer, but just giving a bit more of the complexity here. It's completely right that there are different timescales at play.
All right, thank you.
So I have a question about this GRB event, this 20415. So are you saying that this one also has periodic oscillations, just like those giant threads? So that's the GRB light. Is that the GRB light curve?
Yes. So I'm not saying anything about this observation. I just know it's a giant flare association. Even the periodicity, I would not go that far. This is just an example of the extreme energy release that you would expect from, if the event is magnetospheric, it would need to have a lot of injected energy. And basically, the bottom line is this can happen if you have these axisymmetric models, can easily explain that.
Yeah, but the GRB emission can be due to a totally different mechanism, right? So it could be totally different from this magnetosphere.
Sure, sure. I think it's just the recent speculation that you have these extra galactic events that could be related to magnetic giant flares.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So what we have done, and we now leave the giant flare and go more into the abundant but less energetic magneta flaring activity, which happens quite generally, that you have a rapidly risen X-ray flow that rapidly decays, and then you have some longer lasting activity. This is usually phase resolved. So if you look at phase resolved spectra, you have a different spectral, different activity depending on the phase where you're in. And this might actually point towards something that is not very symmetric, as probably nature does not have to be. And with all that in mind, we changed the models that existed so far into something that is more three-dimensional, just like on the sun, where you have three-dimensional processes, even though it's a different regime. And how do we adapt these simulations? So before we had this ring-like shearing of foot points to generate magnetospheric instabilities, now we change this into this disk-like. So you have a conducting sphere, but you choose a field line bundle depending on the latitude of the center of this disk and then the size of this disk. And then you slowly rotate this bundle of field lines to create a flux tube, really, and see what happens if this becomes unstable. And if you remember on the last slide of the axisymmetric case, you always have these global large-scale eruptions. And the top outcome of this new work that we have is that we actually found that we have to consider yet a different instability, namely some confined kink-like instability. And if I play this movie here, what you will see is a gradual twisting of this magnetosphere. The red color is a current, so you see actually a current of a flux tube building up, similar to like some Z-pinch structure in the plasma community. And you see periodic relaxations where energy is dissipated in these events, but without a global opening of the magnetosphere. We then compare this to different geometries of this twisting region. And we found that indeed, if you do it correctly, or if you set up parameters that are beneficial, you can generate again these global eruptions that kind of open up the magnetosphere and dissipate a lot of energy. And we came up with a criterion that can tell you, depending on this very idealized initial conditions of this disk, what does the size of the disk and the position of the disk say about if a magnetosphere will be globally erupting or staying confined during eruptions. It's basically an energy argument, so it's quite neat. Everything for us is magnetic energy. So if you twist the flux tube close to the equator, you will have a lot of magnetic pressure pushing on from the outside. So you will need a lot of energy to overcome this pressure and create a global eruption. So everything that is closer to the equator and smaller in terms of twisting region will create these kink instabilities, and everything that is closer to the pole and becomes larger will generate these global eruptions. So we kind of complete the picture of morphology of magnetospheric activity that we could imagine from such large-scale heatline dynamics.
So, Jens, one question. So
please.
One thing you're not considering here is the angular rotation of the star being misaligned, or is it just still there's a natural kind of direction? So of the rotation of the star and the magnetic field of the star, and then the twist decided extra. And the other question, so yes, you said the rotation of the star you're not considering. Is this something that Carrasco, Valenzuela, and colleagues have taken a look at recently? Maybe you can have a full picture if you combine the two results.
Yes. So this is they have a wonderful code that does not have an axis at the they do not have the symmetry axis. Maybe I go to the first question first. So rotation of the star for us would be misaligned with the rotation of this disk. So rotation of the star for us will still be with this axis. And you would not have only a polar cap shear. So you would really take this polar cap shear and tilt it to somewhere else while the star keeps rotating. So that's for the first one. So and then we did try this with the rotation, but numerically we cannot get it to work because it's so much stress on this axis. So that's why we kind of disregard it here. It's a fair assumption for what we have in mind. I think that would be great. I suggested it to them, and I think they are more into independent confirmation of results at this point. But they do have already some 3D work on this, in which they see the global eruptions that I will show you on the next slide. But I do not believe that they also found this kink, which also was not that relevant at the time, I think, to explain giant flare events.
All right, thank you.
So yeah, wonderful group, a wonderful code. I wish I could work with it. A little plasma excursion, which we can cut short. People are not interested. So I gave an example for the instability criterion of this flux tube based on the magnetic pressure pressing on it from the outside. What one can also do is to have a more like fundamental plasma approach and think about the safety factor, for example, of a Z-pinch configuration. It is a bit tricky because it's not like in a tokamak or something where you never run into the boundary. Here you have the line tying at the surface of the star, which means that it's not an open flux tube, but it's confined by its ends. But still, you can do some estimates of the safety factor that is also present in the laboratory devices. And we see that basically as we cross a safety factor of about 1, which is what you would expect, you trigger this instability. And this instability for us is a kink-like instability, which when you cut through the flux tube at the equator and look at the current, which is the colorful plot here, and the dissipation, which is the inset, you see that during the kink event, you have these very characteristic small-scale current sheets here where dissipation happens, which is also found in, for example, jets or other contexts where you could have this kink developing. So all of these cases become unstable. How they become unstable is the question. Do they kink or do they explode? And this is what we also have to explore on a more fundamental level, which we have not yet completed. But what we're looking at with a student, like what kind of different instabilities can you get in this highly magnetized regime with the line-tied bounds of a flux tube? I've talked already about the the larger eruptions that open up the magnetosphere also for these 3D configurations that we are running with the twisting disk. And this has intrigued us for quite a long time because so a previous work that I've been done and I will be talking about is about radio wave generation in the outer magnetosphere. And for why this can have many reasons, which we talk about, one of them could be that there's something happening in the inner magnetosphere that sends some pulse or energetic modes to the outer magnetosphere, where then something happens that generates the radio. So there have been, I think, two examples where a radio observation here in red follows X-ray activity, for example, an outburst. And of course, this very famous one where you have two FRBs coinciding with an X-ray eruption of a magnetar. And our model for this has become, I think, very neat. So what I show you in this simulation is a slight change of initial conditions where the twisting disk is in general larger and closer to the equator. So on our phase transition diagram, this would be something that is on the border between eruption and kink. And what we see if I play this is you have the twisted configuration. It first has this confined eruption, but after some time, it really opens up widely, creates this current sheet and has a, yeah, really sends some energy actually, which we see in this blob into the outer magnetosphere. And I would say later why this is interesting or important, but this is basically the second case that you can have not the confined eruption where energy is locally dissipated, likely available for the X-ray, but something on a larger scale where reconnection and energy outflow would work together to create signals of different kinds. I pause for question, but otherwise I can go on and talk a bit more about, yeah, fundamental kind of processes. I have this slide, which is quite kind of interesting.
I have a question there. So
yes.
So that can you go back? Yeah. So why is the radio burst before the X-ray burst for that bottom left part?
Yeah, that is something we cannot really explain here. So for us, I'm not sure about what we can actually say about the timing. Like if what I see is here is that they kind of coincide, and this is what we take. It's like we want to understand how X-ray activity and radioactivity can be immediately related. About the exact timing, I cannot make a statement. Actually, it's also a bit like luminosity wise, this one is very faint. This one is a bit brighter, but still might not be an exact match for the mechanism we have in mind here. But it is the motivation to think about how X-ray activity and radioactivity of magnetars can be related. So it's a bit unsatisfactory, but it's only two observations. So we will see what happens in the future, I think.
So your model is like the current sheets generate X-ray emission, and then this outflows when it goes out at a further distance, then it generates the radio emission. That's your model, right? Okay.
Yeah, so basically our model says that, and I should make that more clear probably, the dissipation happening in the immediate surrounding of the star would shine in the X-ray in some way. Let's discuss cavities on the next slide. And then you have these ejections of actually fast waves in the first model, which we will discuss a bit, that can generate additional X-ray activity. All these giant blobs that are actually nonlinear structures that propagate outwards without any dissipation. They are just really perturbations to the magnetosphere that go into the wind that could then trigger radioactivity. I will say a bit more about the generation mechanisms in a bit.
So James, two questions, and maybe the second question you're about to address when you said this thing about the radio. But so the first one, do you have a curiosity, do you have a luminosity versus time plot for this process? I just want to see
what sort of structure would you say, would you see as this process goes on? Does it just only flat luminosity, out of curiosity, the are handy, be great to see. But the second question is, so in this model you say, well, if the X-rays are produced very close to star and the radio further out, how does that jive with the picture of a pulsar emission where we see both X-ray and radio? Is that the same that you assume play out there, that the radio is emitted further out from the star and the X-ray is a lot closer?
It was a bit noisy. I hope I understood it correct. If I answer inconsistently now, then just ask again. So it is true that also in the pulsar we see this coincidence. And I mean, radio emission can happen in the pulsar magnetosphere much closer to the star, at least with the mechanisms that we have in mind here, because the conditions are good. So there is a problem with the magnetosphere and high-frequency radio waves in the inner magnetosphere, namely that likely they will not be able to escape from there due to some resonances, while the X-ray would be fine to escape from the inner magnetosphere. So this is why, for us, we really need to transport energy somewhere away from the star to seed the fast or radio waves in a place where they will not be dissipating and never able to leave. In the pulsar, this is of course different because magnetic fields are different, and also some of these interaction cross sections are different. So that's why the mechanism in itself may be similar, but has to happen at different places.
Thank you.
I hope it was. I really didn't understand much of the question. I'm sorry. Great. So let's talk a bit about how to make this more realistic and get all of the possible issues that there are a lot of out of the way. So one very nice, and I'm a bit of a fanboy of this group in Washington, observation, is this nicer observation that has been published last year of magnetar activity. So they look at different light curves in the X-ray, and they now really identify hotspots, like with the thermal spectrum, bursting activity, and they trace it over time, and then look at what happens with the phase-resolved distribution of energy that they see in the aftermath of a burst. So for 37 days, and I will play a movie now with different frames being different days, they check what the phase-resolved spectrum basically does. And while initially they have three peaks here, over time these peaks actually merge together. They also shift across the phase. Some of them shrink and they fade. So basically what I want to say with this is there's a lot of activity going on in these bursts that is, I think, not well understood and also not at all consistent with the ideal kind of boundary conditions that we give our problem, which is very rigid, very spherical, very round, might not actually be what's happening in reality. So one thing for the future that has to be understood much better, and where I'm really at the end of any knowledge that I may have at the moment, is to understand actually how the crust of a magnetar evolves in these bursts, how they could drive perturbations in the magnetosphere, how it couples one to the other and backwards. So if this is something I really would like to understand better, but it involves a completely different regime of physics. So while in the outer magnetosphere, I just use Maxwell's equations to do something in there, you have to take care of crystalline lattices and then, of course, superconduction in the interior. So this is very interesting and we completely disregard. Another thing that is interesting, cavity, is that in the models I show you, I continuously inject this twist. So I twist this these field lines at the same velocity the whole time and generate you some lovely looking dissipation events and periodic bursts. But another question could be in this kind of in this movie, what happens if the field lines would stop rotating after some time? How would it have affected the spin down rate of the magnetar, for example? How stable is this? Will it have additional dissipation events? We don't know. Then the question of energy. So in all of these models that I've been showing you, we use these idealized spherical disks, and we find that all the energy dissipation events during bursts we find are way below giant flare events. So we are basically still in the regime of X-ray bursts. So it's 10 to the 41 to 43 erg of total dissipated energy, but much less than in the giant flare. So this could be mitigated if you stop having such ideal notions of boundary conditions. Like, you remember in the exosymmetric case, you have ring-like structures. Here you have this disk. Maybe it could be something in between or something extended. Then it would be much easier to have higher kind of energies. And then some very interesting recent progress, also coming from Canada, of course, is this study of how the fundamental cross-sections, for example, of the pair production that would need to happen in the magnetosphere to fill it with plasma could change in these highly magnetized magnetospheres. So the picture people have been using so far for pair cascades that are created there and populate the magnetosphere is also a decade or more old, I think, and does not take into account these changed cross-sections. And if you ask me, so you model plasma in the magnetosphere, but what do you actually know about that plasma? Then the answer is very disappointing, and this should be studied in the future, and also we do not at all look at. Final disclaimer here, which also comes from this Washington group. So a lot of people work hard on actually understanding the radiation physics in the magnetosphere and where it becomes optically thick and could actually have a back reaction on the dynamics of the magnetic fields. We completely disregard it here, which is a large cavity also of these models. But as we are interested more in the generation of instabilities and how much energy they in general could provide, I think we are still relevant enough with our results to coexist with this. If there are no questions here, I will quickly talk about the fundamental kind of wave generation processes that happen during these instabilities, and then go to our FRB project, which will be quick to wrap up this presentation. So in the kinking magnetospheres that have these confined eruptions, what we see if we look at the energy in the magnetosphere, this is the free energy, then this is built up, and in each eruption you have a tiny amount of dissipation that happens periodically based on the speed of rotation that you would have. You see some non-ideal fields developing in the inner magnetosphere, and this kind of spikes during each of these dissipation events, which would be expected for current sheets in the kink events. And you see, if you measure at some distance, tiny outflows of pointing flux in this magnetosphere at different radii. Tiny because compared to this scale, what is relevant for the other kind of eruptions with the global outflow of energy is almost not noticeable and requires some zoom in of three orders of magnitude or something to produce something. And this is interesting because so we wanted to check what this actually is, what generates this outflow. And it turns out if I play this video now, you will see a cut through our 3D domain. The color is the twist in the phi direction. So it's a bit reduced dimension of a complex problem. And in the bottom plane, you will see this electric or magnetic dominance marker that I talked to about in the previous slide. So whenever you will see something here, the electromagnetic fields have become electrically dominated. There are electric zones that develop. And I want to show the video first before we talk about it. So we start twisting the magnetosphere, then you have some eruptions. And after each eruption, you have these kind of waves propagating outwards that develop E larger than B. These waves are fast magnetosonic waves that are seeded by this compression motion during a kink event. And fast magnetosonic waves grow in amplitude relative to the background magnetic field that decays with the third power as they propagate outwards. and then can develop these electric zones. This is a bit new. So people have just been thinking about this in the last year or so, that actually when you develop these electric zones, your characteristics from force-free electrodynamics, which just has this propagation of waves and no shocks or discontinuities, can actually change theoretically, not in my code, and shocks could develop that could further drive X-ray activity in these objects. So Andrei Bilobrodov in New York has a theoretical work on this, which very carefully looks at the characteristics of a flow that develops E comparable to B. And then there have been some PIC simulations that also run pulses into these decaying fields and then shock. And this is, I think, a very nice feature, which actually only came out of this because the referee was very smart in guiding us in this direction. So this was extremely good learning, I think, coming out of this whole process. So this is a bit new, but if there are no questions, we can compare it to the case where we don't have, yes.
Very good question. So in one of your plots, you have a plot of E dot B. So does that mean you're not using force-free electrodynamics here? You're developing an E dot B not equal to zero, or can you say a little bit about that?
So I am using force-free electrodynamics, but some experience show me that it's better to be honest up front about these methods. And basically, all force-free electrodynamics codes will develop these non-ideal electric fields on a low level if the flow is smooth. But of course, if you trigger reconnection events like in current sheets, then they will spike. Which is natural because in reality, you should have some interplay between the magnetic energy and the kinetic energy of the flow, which cannot happen here because no kinetics is modeled. So there has to be some dissipation, which is not according to the correct rates, but it can still be there. And it can pile up and eventually break your simulation. So all that may happen. And it is really just a tracer here. For us to, so in the end here, for example, I would stop trusting the simulation eventually because it's not spiky anymore and this is just dissipating a lot. But up to then, I think it's very well resolved that we only have strong E dot B when there's a dissipation event in the magnetosphere and it is fine. So I kind of just want to allow people to judge the quality of this simulation rather than saying it's all as it should be. Yeah, so it is always hard to kind of, sorry, I shouldn't get too deep into it, but it's always hard to like measure, for example, the amount of dissipation via reconnection in a force-free simulation or the timescale exactly because of that. So in our code, we just cut all non-ideal electric fields quite rapidly. There are more elaborate techniques for that can mitigate it a bit, but it's always a bit critical. If we go to the case, so actually it's good that we talked about this. So if we go to the case where we have this global eruption and have like extended current sheets in the magnetosphere, then this picture changes a bit. So we have a lot of dissipation going on here during this global eruption. And what also happens is that in addition to some E dot B, which is quite significant during these current sheet rearrangements, you also develop E larger than B close to the star, which is a marker of non-guide field reconnection, which is basically going on here. So if I plot this, then initially you have seen some of these waves, but then you really see the reconnection event and global structures leaving the magnetosphere. You see from the bottom axis some problematic stuff moving in at the end. But what I kind of want to point out is that during the reconnection events where these big structures were expelled, you do not see this dissipation anymore in this channel. So what is likely happening is that, this topological structure that is expelled, like a blob of field lines or other works, call it spheromag in the Lyutikov group, actually expands without dissipation and can quite quite stably be advected into the outer magnetosphere, which we also see when we look at the pointing flux that is just stably being advected further out and could then generate something in the outer magnetosphere.
Question?
Please.
Yeah, so if I look at the small top left plot, focusing on the black line, I see one slope, then a saturation, and then it takes off with a different slope. Do you understand that? Isn't that surprising?
You mean in this growth, basically?
Yeah.
Yes. So I think this is. I think it's an artifact of the ongoing twisting, and that we likely, even though we try to twist as slow as possible, still twist this too fast. So likely what will happen is that you trigger this magnetospheric rearrangement, you have some reconnection event, but you keep twisting and already drive it into the next instability. So you in this different slope, what you will see is some leftover. We did some convergence studies with this, so we see similar, the slopes become nicer and eruptions are still there for slower twists, but it's extremely expensive simulation, so we had to go with this kind of compromise. So it's a good spot that these different slopes are likely from an artifact of still twisting the field line foot points too fast.
All right, thank you.
Very good. So now we have stuff happening in the inner magnetosphere being transporting other stuff into the outside magnetosphere. And I just want to wrap up this talk by saying what could then happen in the outer magnetosphere. And we have this work on one fast radio burst generation mechanism, which is just one against between like several of them. And in this talk, I do not want to make a judgment of which one is it or is it not, but I want to kind of say that we have all the ingredients for this one, which coincidentally we also worked on before, which is of course extremely nice. Maybe I skip this for now, so let's look at fast radio bursts first and then go into the fundamentals of this. So fast radio bursts are millisecond duration radio events that arrive to us from space. When they arrive, they're highly dispersed, this one. That means that there's this chirping motion, and then you have to de-disperse them with different techniques that can either focus on good signal-to-noise ratio or interesting structures, and then it will give you a spectrum that you can then analyze, which we will come to on one of the next slides. And of course, thanks to telescopes in Canada, we have now a lot of these events. I saw two. What was it? Two telescopes.
Oh, Victory, because I'm in Canada. Sorry.
Ah, Victory. Okay. I was panicking that I maybe have only 2 minutes left, but that seems fine.
Sorry. No.
And it's okay. So this is of course great, because now we have actually a population of FRBs where people start seeing subpopulations. This particular work does not develop a subpopulation that I'm now explaining, but I just want to make the point that we are now getting into a critical mass of events where one maybe one day could even identify different emission mechanisms and finalize kind of the understanding of this. And what we did in modeling one possible emission mechanism is we set up kinetic simulation. So we changed our regime from force-free simulation to particle-in-cell simulation that actually have plasma macroparticles and consistent interactions between them. And what we do is we postulate that a low-frequency magnetic pulse or structure, similar to the one we ejected on the previous slides, would move into the magnetar wind and collide with the current sheet in this magnetar wind, which is striped outflow. Striped is I forgot the term for it. Striped, anyway. And then we see what the reconnection that is triggered by this low frequency pulse has as a signature on the other side. And we do so by a very simple but then complex in its execution setup of a Harris current sheet. So that means it's a pressure stabilized field reversal, which is subject to this magnetic pulse, which is a fast magnetosonic wave, and propagates against the current sheet, picks up the current sheet and carries it around with it for some time, and induces some compressed reconnection in the process. So if the setup is kind of clear, I will move to a video of what this would look like. This is the setup. It's a bit, you have to bear with me for a second. Here you see the current of the current sheet initially. What you don't see is that there's a fast magnetosonic wave here. Fast magnetosonic waves don't carry current, so you cannot see it here, at least in this channel. On the top, you see the EZ component of the magnetic field, which is the component coming out of your screen. And the EZ component would also be the component of electric field that is belonging to this pulse that is not here, but there. And you cannot see anything there right now because we filter out kind of the low frequency part of the background pulse, because we want to see the high frequency fast magnetosonic or radio waves that may be injected in the process. Once I start the movie, this pulse will move upwards and start compress the current sheet, and then you will see the axis moving as we have to move the window along with the pulse that carries the current sheet for quite some time. Very complex setup, and I should maybe have a cartoon of this, but I hope you understand. If I now start this movie, then we see the compression of the current sheet. So scales become small. And then we see these plasmoids emerging that, when they merge, induce a current. And this current can act as a plasma antenna to inject fast magnetosonic waves. So as these plasmoid mergers go on, you induce more and more of these fast magnetosonic waves. And even when reconnection has stopped and the current sheet kind of has left this background pulse, you still have the high frequency wave signature on top of it that could then propagate outwards and convert hopefully into fast radio bursts. It's noted here that this is of course a generation mechanism. Many people work on actual propagation of fast radio bursts, which is also probably now a hotter topic than the generation itself. I do not go into this part of the FRBs.
So this bifurcation of plasmoid, is it some kind of instability of the current sheet, or is completely driven by this injecting wave?
Yes. So great question. I have a slide for that. So it's actually a mechanism that is rather fundamental, and I think that's why it's interesting. So this merging plasmoid injecting wave mechanism is actually not first discussed in this context, but it has become popular in the context of these pulsar nanoshots. There's also radio waves that are on top of the main pulse of a pulsar. It's here observed from the CREP. It's very short duration, nanosecond duration, high energetic shots in the radio band. And the attempt to explain this was made similarly with these plasmoid mergers that can inject radio waves when they merge. And here we see just what happens. So you have two of these plasmoids, which are high in density, that come together and they generate this secondary reconnection event between them. So you have a current flowing in this secondary current sheet here that will then inject a wave, which you can see here in the pointing flux going outwards. One can discuss more of how exactly it happens, but the bottom line is basically that in every reconnection event, you would have such plasmoid mergers and some waves injected with some conversion efficiency. And that's kind of what I want to stress, because I know, for example, Luciano also works on, for example, jets that merge and then have a reconnection event, which is very interesting. And similar things could just happen there. You would have a reconnection event with plasmoids merging, injecting waves. Similar things could also happen by other processes in the magnetomagnetosphere. For example, if you drive nonlinear Alfvén waves, you will create a reconnection event very close to the star that has plasmoid mergers and would inject waves. But the question you always have to ask yourself then is, what is the environment of the wave injection? And what is the frequency of the waves that will be generated? Okay, I've talked a long time to answer your question. So the special thing that's happening here in this magneta case that I'm discussing is that you have this strong compression of magnetic fields. And that basically acts as a boost that brings your wave frequency of the plasmoid merging fast waves into the gigahertz or FRB regime. If you would have the same but happening in the interior magnetosphere without compression, you can still have fast waves, but they will not be in the right frequency regime. So this is kind of the game you have to play. Okay, long answer. Sorry about that. I hope it clarified a few things.
Can I talk a little bit about why? So how would you explain that radio are not even higher frequencies? How do you shield all other possibles? Why don't we see X-rays or gamma rays associated to these?
Right, that's a good question. So it is, then it really, I think, becomes a fine-tuning problem that we can discuss. So so the question is basically why can the events we see still be very narrow band, for example, which is here in the green part of such a dynamic spectrum. And I can only explain it if really like all the conditions match, like if you would have a pulse coming in with the correct compression, which has to be actually extremely high in nature, like you would need a pulse that has a magnetic field of, I don't know, 10,000 times the background magnetic field, that would then generate this reconnection event and really boost it into this frequency range. And the frequency of injected waves depends on the size of the plasmoid structures. So if you have this going on with the correct size, giving you the correct frequency, and then reconnection will stop and your emission will stop, for example, because the wind expands and it just freezes out, kind of plasmoids cannot reach each other anymore and it stops. Then you could probably explain some of these narrowband behavior. But this, I am aware that this becomes an extreme fine-tuning problem at that moment. That's correct.
Thank you.
So I wonder if I can just go back to your previous point to make sure I understand. So when you have the Harris current sheet, is that already going to be unstable to forming these plasmoids without the plasma wave, and the role of the plasma wave is to boost that to higher frequencies? Is that the main point?
Very good question as well. So in nature, of course, this would be a process where reconnection would be already ongoing, and it would be an equilibrium reconnecting current sheets. What we start with here is a current sheet that is well stabilized by just the width and the it has, so that by itself, in reasonable time, it would not start reconnecting. One could argue that maybe it would be better to start from an equilibrium, but then simulation becomes more tedious and expensive. So this is what we went with. And if you would not have the background magnetic pulse, it would pretty much not develop any plasmoids during the entire simulation. But the compression is really what drives the reconnection rate up. So when you compress it, you see a spike in reconnection rate. You see onset of reconnection, and then you really start from the smallest structures going to the largest one. That's what we see. In nature, of course, there would be reconnection already ongoing, and one would have to think about that. Okay, I think it's only one slide after this, so I should be right in time. I just want to say, while a lot of what I mentioned is related to fine-tuning, there's still one case for a nice observational feature that can be explained quite naturally with this process, and also a nice statement of generality of this process that I want to make. The first one is related to these frequency drifts that can be seen in some FRBs. And the process I just described to you is intrinsically hierarchical. So you start with small plasmoid structures and they merge and become larger. And the injected frequency at the fast of the fast waves depends on the size of the merging structures. So very naturally, what we see in these dynamic spectra, which are not at all comparable directly to the other ones from observations, but we do see these downward drifts in frequencies and also small scale structures happening in time. Here I show it for different strengths of synchrotron cooling. Synchrotron cooling can be a helper in this regard. So you would have strong synchrotron cooling that make all your structures in this current sheet smaller again. So basically stronger cooling, smaller plasmoids kind of argument. So you actually rely on a strong cooling in the magnetar wind close to the light cylinder where this would happen, that would drive you further into this frequency range that you want. And the generality statement, so if I look at the reconnected energy in these simulations for different pulse amplitudes, and then check how much energy is in the fast wave channel, then I basically find that between reconnected energy and fast waves, you have this efficiency of 10 to the minus 3, and you have 10 to the minus 1 efficiency between the total energy and reconnected energy. And this 10 to the minus 4 total conversion efficiency is exactly the same you find without compression. So it's a nice finding, I think. And we applied it to these FRBs, but also could be applied to different cases, that if you know your conversion efficiency of 10 to the minus 4 without compression, you can just model whatever you want without compression, and then you can boost it to the kind of environment where you want it, where you expect this and this compression, and you would be able to say what's the energy that is available in the end, and of course the frequency. I'm sure there's time for question. I skipped this one. So just the summary slide and then come to the end. What I've talked to you about is, of course, with a lot of limitations and things that still have to be done, a take on kind of lower luminosity X-ray bursts and their possible connection to radio events in the outer magnetosphere. So we've shown some eruption models for giant flare events, which rely on exosymmetric, strongly sheared magnetospheres that easily liberate a lot of energy. And then we've changed the setup to intrinsically 3D shears with this twisting disk that liberate a lot less energy than giant flares. But they have interesting dynamics, like the kink instability that has not been considered in depth so far. And you have these possibilities of injecting either high-frequency fast waves by the kink that could become electrically dominated at shock, or you could have these ejections of energetic bubbles that could propagate to the outer magnetosphere. And in the outer magnetosphere, I showed you one possible FRB generation mechanism that has some nice features and, of course, therefore your enjoyment or criticism. And in total, I think we can combine this and say that with all the possible things for further work aside, it seems to be quite realistic to say that inner activities in the inner magnetosphere could have, depending on their different structure, different effects on radiative processes in the outer magnetosphere. And that's it of the main talk. I'm happy to take questions, of course, and also meet later on Zoom if somebody has the need or time for private discussion on any of that.
Any questions from the online audience? Maybe I can ask a question first. So you're trying to also explain the giant flare using this twist of flux bundles, right? Like why it cannot be just, I don't know, the foot point of the magnetic field just, I don't know, just change dramatically for Jennifer. I guess that kind of huge twist can also possible release a lot of energy to the magnetosphere and possibly produce a Jennifer. Why is that not a possibility?
Can you explain again what kind of twist you've been thinking about for this one?
So you have this magnet. Okay, let me. So this, right, you're just trying to look at this kind of twist for flux bundle, but the magnetic field like foot point can twist like this, right? Like and rotate for large angles, and then this kind of twist, I mean, can also release a lot of magnetic energy to the magnetosphere, possibly produce the jet drive without. I mean, one such this kind of event can release all of that.
Yeah. So I agree. I agree. So it could be different kind of twisting geometries, but also if you have a large enough hotspot, basically twisting region, basically. And if you, I mean, it would also be allowed to have several events kind of and keep generating free energy that would then approach giant flare type levels. I think this possibility is also there. So none of that is excluded now. I think we just, we're content with very simplistic boundaries because we don't actually know what the realistic motion would look like. So I think it's, in the end, it will be something in between and probably can explain also higher energies. Indeed, I agree.
So James, I have a question. So you have here involved in some sense two things. You have the magnetar, and the magnetar uses these fast points, and then these fast waves that go up, and then this is where you say the emission of the fast waves maybe. Can you speculate of whether the second ingredient is robust, like some FRBs are very unlikely to be magnetars, but can you say, would you speculate that the second piece would perhaps be robust enough to be translated into whatever the engine of these FRBs may be?
I think I did not hear all of the questions. So I'm speculating about the second peak you said, sorry.
No, sorry. What I'm trying to say is, so we have FRBs that are likely magnetars, and then we have other FRBs that are unlikely magnetars.
Yes.
So in here in your model, you have a magnetar that produces something, these plasmons, etc. And then there is a story that you can connect with to something that may be an explanation of fast radio burst. So can I take away the magnetar as the inner engine? But I still think that the second aspect is robust enough to be applicable to the other models where you wouldn't have a magnetar.
So this mechanism, and I think this is the nice thing with the reconnection mediated fast wave injection. I would be really confident in saying that. So one thing we have shown here is that these simulations we did are a overkill for the problem. So pretty much if you would have your reconnection rate, if you would have your efficiency of fast wave generation even without compression, and then you would boost that into some into whatever background magnetic field compression you want to have, you can make a statement about the frequency of the outgoing waves. And then what you also need is kind of the duration of the event. And the duration of the event is probably as long as reconnection goes on. And so you have to ask yourself, is there enough flux in your system that can generate millisecond duration bursts? For the magnetar, it's already borderline because there might not actually be enough electric magnetic flux to last for a millisecond, but more like a tenth of a millisecond. So these are like questions you have to ask yourself. And then you can assemble them, I think, in this process to make a statement about if you would have the correct frequency and the correct duration and the correct energy. So in this sense, it's very neat. And I know that there are like a lot of problems with the magnetar application of this, but it can be generalized to, I think, other objects if you want.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, thank you again for having me. And again, feel free to reach out anytime. I'd be happy to chat.
Yeah, let's thank James again.